So many of you, if you don't know, you will know by the end of this session that racism is a determinant of health and illness. Okay? Experiencing racism, we know, takes away from the health and well-being of multiple populations in this country. So earlier this summer, we at APHA launched a webinar series entitled The Impact of Racism on the Health and Well-Being of the Nation. The unfortunate events in Charleston, South Carolina, Baltimore, Maryland, and Ferguson, Missouri reminded us that stigma, inequalities, and civil rights injustices remain in our society today. Unfortunately, skin color plays a large part in how people are viewed, valued, and treated. We know that racism, both intentional and unintentional, affects the health and well-being of individuals and communities and stifles the opportunity of many to contribute fully to the future and growth of this nation. This summer, as I said, APHA hosted a four-part webinar series about racism's impact on health and disparities. Each webinar featured dynamic presenters and subject matter experts, a couple of whom we have in this room with us today, including APHA leadership and PAC leadership, such as Dr. Adewale Troutman and our former leader, Dr. Kamara Jones, and I see Dr. Linda Ray Murray has joined us as well, all part of the leadership legacy at the American Public Health Association. They participated and spoke on racism and its influence on violence, healthcare, and education. The first webinar was entitled Naming and Addressing Racism, a Primer. The second was No Safety, No Health, a conversation about race, place, and preventing violence. The third was Unequal Treatment, Disparities in Access, Quality, and Care, which we revisited the landmark report that came out of the IOM on unequal treatment and examined where are we today, okay, after that report. That landmark report. And the fourth was racism, the silent partner in high school dropout and health disparities. The series garnered the highest webinar participation rates to date for APHA. Okay? I get goose pimples. I've been a member of APHA since 1983. So this was major to see this come out in this kind of a way. And over 21,000 registrants. 21,000 registrants registered for this seminar, for the webinar series, 10,100 participants in live events, over 7,000 replays of archived recordings, and more than 3,000 tweets and retweets. Historical in APHA, all right? Clearly, there's an appetite for this information and this dialogue. If we didn't think this so before, we now know. So we're going to continue the conversation, and we need to hear from you. We invite you to take a brief survey and let us know your thoughts on the webinar series and also what support you need in your efforts to address the impact of racism and health. We need to hear from you. We have to make a case for why this is important, and we want to be very targeted in the strategies that we employ in going forward. The webinar series was something we thought about in our office. And lo and behold, obviously, there was great interest and engagement in it. So now where do we go? And we're eager to hear from you. And so we're doing this kind of this quick, brief statement in several sessions throughout APHA. So if you've responded already, please don't respond again, although maybe you should respond again. Maybe it won't hurt when you respond again. Okay. So that, I know, is on tape. However, it's okay. It's all right. So we want to know your thoughts on the series and also what support you need to create the healthiest nation in one generation. We must address the root causes of health inequities. If you wanted to view the webinar recordings, because you didn't before, and access the slides for each presentation, you can go to our website, www.apha.org/racism. Plain and simple, and you can access those recordings. But what I would like you to do, I'm going to quietly distribute a survey that I will ask you to please complete and drop off at the booth at the exhibit, the Center for Public Health Policy exhibit, because that's where we are doing the analysis and doing the planning going forward. So please, if completed, even if you didn't listen to the series, because we want your insight into what would be helpful to you to move forward on this particular central challenge, as well as understanding and unpacking what we mean about racism and health. Okay? I hope I can count on you to do that. It'll be a blue sheet, and I'm going to pass it out quietly, and we would really appreciate you if you take 5 minutes to complete this brief survey so that we can be responsive to you, to what you need to go forward. Okay? Can I count on you for that? Okay, thank you. So without further ado, it gives me great joy to be present and alongside a dear colleague, friend, advocate, partner. We were on the board together with APHA, Dr. Kamara Phyllis Jones, who probably needs no introduction, right? She probably needs no introduction. I said, so who's going to introduce you? She said, but you probably need no introduction, because surely you are familiar with her work, okay? Surely you're familiar with her advocacy around these very important issues in our community. Surely you're familiar with her research that she has put out there, because you risk to put research out there so that we all can understand what this means in our community. So I don't think she needs an introduction. What do you all think? Okay. I love you, and please keep doing what you do.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for being in this room. Because when I become the president of APHA Wednesday afternoon, to take our association and as many other national organizations and other groups as will join us in leading a national campaign against racism. And I want this session to help inform that national campaign. What I'm going to do is to provide an international context of why I even think this is appropriate for me as APHA president, because, you know, not everybody in APHA is quite ready to even say the word racism, right? And in fact, at first I was thinking, ooh, maybe I shouldn't jump out like that. Maybe I should, you know, do public health and education or something. You know, there are a lot of important things I could take from my presidency, until I was talking with a young person. It was from the maternal and child health section, one of their fellows. I was on the phone. He said, Dr. Jones, what are you going to do with your presidency? And I said, oh, you know, I'm a little nervous. My whole career has been on racism and health, but I don't know if I should jump out there. And he said to me, Dr. Jones, if not you, who? And if not now, when? So we are going. So just today, you'll notice I'm the only speaker listed in the program, but that's because I want all of us to have a conversation. I am going to present an international context. I'm going to present some definitions. Many, if not all of you in this room, are familiar with many of my allegories on race and racism, so I'm not going to present them to you as if this is something new, but I'm going to present them to you so that you can, I'll even talk about what are the salient points, so you can tell these back, so that you can become part of our army in terms of naming racism, which is the first stage in being actively anti-racist. And then I want to have explicit brainstorming about APHA roles and partners. And I know that there are many people in this room who are either leaders of other organizations that are willing and ready to partner with us in this effort, or you may be on the board of, maybe not quite leading, and you could bring those other organizations to us. At any time during this session, I would invite you, if you have something to add, to stand up and raise your hand. There's no microphone here, so you'll have to say it, and I'll have to repeat whatever your comment is briefly into the microphone for the tape. But at any point, even if you want to challenge something I'm saying, or think I have incomplete thinking, or even if you want to give me an amen at any point, then I want your input, because this is a brainstorm. I won't have another room like this, readily available to feed that information to me. So, how many in this room have ever heard of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination? This is fabulous. So now we have a room where about a third of the people have heard of this. What it is an international anti-racism treaty. that was adopted by the UN General Assembly way back in 1965. Now, for the two-thirds who never heard about it, you're like, really? Is there an international anti-racism treaty? Indeed, there is. But I'm going to ask those who never heard of this before, do you think that the U.S. signed this treaty?
No.
Of course not, right? But yes, yes, the U.S. did sign the treaty in 1966. That's a revelation in itself. But here's the key there. Our diplomats can go and sign any treaty they want, but it doesn't have any force over us unless our Senate ratifies the treaty. So here's a follow-up question. Do you think the U.S. Senate ratified this treaty? Surprise, surprise, surprise. The U.S. Senate ratified the treaty 28 years later, a generation later, but in 1994. What that means is that today, the United States has international treaty obligations to do right under this 9-page treaty. One of the obligations is to submit periodic reports. So our State Department, every 6 years, submits a report to the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. The most recent report was submitted in 2013. And not just the State Department, but 82 other organizations also submitted reports on their view of how we were doing under the treaty. And actually, APHA could, with the next cycle, be one of those organizations. Any organization, any individual can submit a parallel report. And the committee, the UN committee, considered all of these reports in 2014. And in September of 2014, they sent back to the State Department their concluding observations, which is just a 14-page document. It is not a telephone book. It's something that we can all read this week, right? And the report, the concluding observations go, thank you, dear United States, for your report. We remain concerned about racial profiling or residential segregation or the achievement gap in education, differential access in health care, disproportionate incarceration, and on and on and on. And not only do they say we remain concerned about, they give specific actionable direction to our nation. They also say, dear United States, we recommend that you increase your efforts to raise the public awareness and knowledge about this treaty. So every time I talk, I do my part, right? But what they further say in paragraph 25 is that the committee recommends that the state party adopt a national action plan to combat structural racial discrimination. We have international treaty obligations to do this. So as far as I'm concerned, it is not just because Kamara Jones has devoted her career to looking at issues of race and racism that we as a nation should be on this. It's because we have international treaty obligations to do so. But then you might ask, why should APHA be involved in this? This was not a directive to our association. This is at the national level. So in order for us to understand why APHA should be in the business of even naming racism, much less asking how is racism operating here, and then trying to organize people and strategize to act, why is racism on our radar? I'm going to start with one of my animations, one of my allegories that many of you in the room are familiar with. But this is a tool that all of you can use when somebody might challenge you, why are you as a health person talking about racism? How many in this room have not seen the cliff analogy before? 2-3 people. Yay! Yay! So you're all familiar, so here we go. Here we go. Boom! Somebody has just fallen off of the cliff of good health, and as you know, if that were you or somebody in your family, you would be delighted to find an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. But if we were to ask ourselves, what could we put in place as a health intervention besides just stationing lots of ambulances at the bottom of the cliff? You know, we can say we need to put in a net to catch people before they get crunched at the bottom. They might fall, but we want to keep them from getting crunched up at the bottom, right? Or we might say, well, you know, even the problem with the nets is that nets have holes in them, and so some people might fall through the cracks. So we might even make that a trampoline halfway down that cliff. No holes in a trampoline. But even if we had a trampoline halfway down the cliff, we might find ourselves with lots of people just bouncing up and down at half functionality, not able to get back to the top of the cliff. So what else could we put in place as a health intervention if we were concerned about others who might come along that cliff face, if we were concerned about population health, public health, community health? Clearly, we need to be thinking about a fence to keep people from falling in the first place. But you know, as good as a fence is, that's going to have to be a super strong fence if there are a lot of people crowded up against it. So another level of health intervention is clearly to move the population away from the edge of the cliff. And you are familiar, most of you, that these innovations that I've described so far can be labeled with the ambulances, medical care, and tertiary prevention. You know, our three levels of prevention: primary, secondary, tertiary. Tertiary is when you prevent complications from disease that's already manifest, like preventing amputations from diabetes and the like. The net or trampoline halfway down, these are our safety net programs, and secondary prevention, early detection, screening programs. The fence at the edge of the cliff, primary prevention, keeping things from happening in the first place. Moving the population away from the edge of the cliff, addressing the social determinants of health, the determinants of health and illness that are outside of the individual, beyond our genes, beyond our individual behaviors, the context in which our behaviors arise in the first place, and the context that make our behaviors either hazardous or beneficial for our health. And so if we were thinking about infant mortality as an outcome, that ambulance might be our neonatal intensive care units. The net or trampoline halfway down might be prenatal care. The fence at the edge might be either, you know, pre-pregnancy programs, or women, infants, and children, excellent maternal nutrition types of programs. Moving the population away from the edge of the cliff might be having excellent educational opportunities for young girls so that they didn't get pregnant as early. These social determinants of health, I know there's a lot of conversation, probably everybody in the room is familiar with what we mean, but they include poverty and adverse neighborhood conditions, as well as beneficial neighborhood conditions. Depends on which side of the fence you're on there, right? But as useful as this diagram would be for us to march into the Illinois State House, right, and say, first of all, fund the government, right? Right? But also to say, how should we be spending our health resources? We would all agree we need some of all of that there, but it's a matter of emphasis. And maybe we don't need all the money to go into ambulances. Maybe we need to be putting a lot of our emphasis on moving the population away from the edge of the cliff. But as useful as this diagram is so far, it has a huge fatal flaw, which is that it does not yet deal with how health disparities arise. So I want you to keep the cliff in the back of your mind. We're going to shift gears very briefly to talk about how health disparities arise, and then we'll come back to the cliff. So how do health disparities arise? Well, especially when you're talking about racial ethnic health disparities, we unfortunately have lots of evidence about differences in the quality of care received within the healthcare system by race or ethnicity. Even if everybody's in the VA system, even if everybody's under Medicare or Medicaid, there are well-documented differences in quality of care. The Institute of Medicine in 2002 pulled together at that time hundreds of studies. Now it would be thousands of studies documenting these differences. But then that IOM panel realized it's not just what happens within the system, because, hey, lots of people can't get into the system to begin with. So they acknowledge a second level at which health disparities arise, which are differences in access to care. But then we in this room understand that health is not created within the health sector. And so there is a huge third level at which health disparities arise, which are differences in our life opportunities, exposures, and stresses, the conditions of our lives that are making some individuals and communities sicker than others in the first place. And so now we've described three levels at which health disparities arise: differences in quality of care, differences in access to care, differences in underlying exposures and opportunities. And it's like a huge pyramid, or better yet, it's like a huge iceberg. And the hidden base, the huge hidden base, are the differences in the quality and conditions of our lives. And then you have most often the people who've been made sicker, the same ones who are frustrated because of limited access to care. And then even the lucky ones who get into the system are sometimes further injured because of differences in quality of care. So now, thinking about those three levels at which health disparities arise, we are going to go back to our cliff, but now we're going to recognize that really we are not dealing with a flat two-dimensional cliff, we are actually dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. And at some parts of the cliff, that ambulance there might have a flat tire so that it's slow or goes off in the wrong direction. Or maybe there's no ambulance there at all, and maybe there's no net nor fence, and usually at those parts of the cliff, the population is being pushed closer to the edge. And so then, now that we recognize we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, well, let me first of all label how health disparities arise on this three-dimensional cliff. The differences in quality of care that I talked about, that's when the ambulance is there, but hey, it's got a flat tire. It's slow or goes off in the wrong direction. Differences in access to care, no ambulance, no net, no fence. Differences in underlying exposures and opportunities, the closer proximity of that greenie population to the edge. And so now we have to ask ourselves a whole new range of questions now that we recognize we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. The first of all, one is, how does the cliff become three-dimensional in the first place? And that's usually because of historical injustices that are perpetuated by present-day contemporary structural factors. But given that we have a three-dimensional cliff, we must ask, why are there differences in how resources are distributed along the cliff face? And why are there differences in who is found at different parts of the cliff? And why are the orangies back here in a way and the greenies being pushed closer to the edge? And when you start asking and addressing these kinds of questions, you are now doing what I describe as addressing the social determinants of equity, which differ from the social determinants of health. Social determinants of health were included individual and neighborhood conditions, poverty and the like. The social determinants of equity are systems of power that can distribute resources and populations into those different contexts. And they include racism, sexism, heterosexism, economic systems like capitalism and the like. And in this cliff analogy, I have actually now distilled three dimensions of health intervention. Going back to your high school or junior high in geometry, one dimension is a line, two dimensions is a plane, three dimensions is space. Well, along that line at the edge of the cliff is where we can display all of our health services. If you say health anywhere in this country, people will complete that thought for you and go to healthcare or health services. This is where all of our conversation in this country is right now. And everyone in this room, I am sure, would endorse the notion of universal access to high-quality health care with a single payer, right? We need that. So let's. But we have to be clear that the reason that we endorse that notion is not that that in and of itself will result in large and sustained improvements in health outcomes or the elimination of health disparities, because as universal as your access is and as great as your system is, you can overwhelm any system. The reason that we endorse that notion is because that is how a civilized society values all of its people equally, right? But if we want to, if we have everybody crowded up against that fence, we can overwhelm any system. We must move into the second dimension that we can display along a flat plane. We have to address the social determinants of health, including poverty, adverse neighborhood conditions, and the like, if we're going to have large and sustained improvements in health outcomes. But then we are at risk if we move the population away from the edge of the cliff without recognizing that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. We might move some of the population and not all of the population to make health disparities worse. So we must acknowledge and address the three-dimensionality of the cliff by addressing the social determinants of equity, including racism, sexism, heterosexism, and the like, if we're going to achieve social justice and eliminate health disparities. Now, often, I stop here and ask people if they have any questions about the cliff. I recognize that many people have seen this before, but I want you to feel confident in using this as a tool. Is there any question right now? Because if not, I want to have a lot of time at the end for you to help the campaign, but I'll stop now if there's any question. Okay. So that wasn't really inviting for questions, was it? I would just say that even for people who are physicians trying to be ambulance drivers, right, the best ambulance drivers they can be, it is important for us to recognize that we have to address all of these levels. It is important for people who are about addressing social determinants of health and might be hesitant to say the word racism to recognize that they have to, that we have to move the population away from the edge of the cliff, but we also have to acknowledge racism and sexism and the other things. It is important for us to understand that in our, wherever we are in terms of our work as citizens, we must address all of this if we're going to have any traction on improving health outcomes and eliminating health disparities. So, I have said the word racism about a gazillion times. You are in here because you are happy that we are going to launch a national campaign against racism. We need to have a common definition that we agree on. We may not all agree on this one, but I'm going to put it forward as a definition, as a candidate definition. When I say the word racism, I'm clear that I'm talking about a system. I am not talking about an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing or even a psychiatric illness, as some people have suggested. I am talking about a system of power, and it's a system of doing what? It's a system of structuring opportunity and of assigning value. And on what basis is that opportunity structured? And on what basis is that value assigned? It's based on the social interpretation of how one looks, which is what we call race in this country. You look at me here in Chicago, hey, I'm clearly black, no question. You look at me in some parts of Brazil, I would be just as clearly white. You look at me in South Africa, I'd be clearly colored. Here I am with the same physical appearance, but the social interpretation of that appearance would assign me to three different racial groups in those three different settings. And furthermore, if I were to stay in any of those settings long enough, my health outcome would take on that of the group to which I've been assigned, even though I'd have the same genes in all three places. So when I talk about race as a social interpretation of how we look in a race-conscious society, that's what I'm talking about. So now I've defined this racism as a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on so-called race. What are the impacts of this system? Well, when we think or talk about racism at all, which is not often enough in this country, but hopefully we're about to change that, we will get to the unfair disadvantage, that this system unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. But hey, it doesn't take very long to recognize that every unfair disadvantage has its reciprocal unfair advantage. So that racism is also unfairly advantaging other individuals and communities. And that's the whole issue of unearned white privilege that we hardly ever talk about in this country. And I'm going to give us some tools to even make that clear and easy to discuss. But even as we recognize that we either have a system that's either unfairly disadvantaging or advantaging individuals and communities, we must recognize that this system is sapping the strength of our whole society through the waste of human resources. We can see that in terms of how we as a nation are not investing vigorously in the full, excellent public education of all of our kids, because the blinders of racism have made us believe that there is no genius in the barrios or the ghettos or the reservations. We can get along very well, thank you, without those kids, right? But that is wrong thinking. We know there's genius in all of our communities. And if we were to fully invest in all of that genius, we would be doing so much better as a nation, or even as a world. And if you've heard me talk before, I know that we would already be up on Mars farming if that were a good thing to do, if we were to invest in all of our genius. Another way that racism saps the strength of the whole society is how these same blinders that make us not value all of our people equally have made us as a nation complacent with what I describe as the wholesale warehousing disproportionately of so many black and brown men in our prison system, as if that did not separate us from human citizens. And if you know somebody, or if you're lucky and maybe you're someone who's been in the system and now you're out, right, you know there's a lot of genius that is either caught up in the prison system or cycling in and out, because when you come out, can't get a job, can't vote in most states, can't get public housing, and what is the option? And if we were to really invest in that genius, we could be doing so much better as a nation and the world. I actually think, and in this national campaign against racism, as we're going to highlight lots of things, I actually think that if we look at how racism saps the strength of the whole society, we might get more traction and people wanting to join our struggle, join this movement to dismantle this system. Because, you know, the unfair disadvantage, oh well, poor them, right? The unfair advantage for our allies, white allies who are in this room right now, when you come to realize that, ooh, this system really is unfairly advantaging me, until you recognize that it's sapping the strength of the whole society, you too might slow down. And so I encourage us to do a lot of data collection on that final bullet about how racism saps the strength of the whole society, a lot of media stories, a lot of conversations around our dinner tables on that point. But now I'm going to go to something that I think everybody in this room knows, my gardener's tale, right? So the question for the cliff analogy, that you can whip that out. If you're asked, why should you as a health person be talking about racism, you whip out the cliff analogy, right? Then you talk about racism as a system. When you talk about racism as a system, then you get out of the job of saying you're racist and you're not, right? Because racism is a system. We are all, I liken it to a cement factory that's spewing cement dust. And if you're anywhere in the vicinity of that factory long enough, maybe half a year in the U.S., I don't know, then you're going to have cement dust in your lungs, right? I'm going to talk about how that cement dust, that racism affects us at different levels in a moment. But the question is not, are you racist or are you not? If you live in this society long enough, you're racist. Let's all just own that right now. A lot of my racism is against me and people who look like me, right? But let's all own that we're all racist. And our job is to put on a gas mask, first of all, to do something to be actively anti-racist, but then not to just feel righteous with our gas mask on, but to help others put that mask on, and then all of us together to try to shut down that factory. That is our strategy, okay? So the second thing, that definition, the utility of that, is that we're not interjudging who's racist and who's not. We are about understanding racism as a system that we have to dismantle. Now, this third thing, the gardener's tale, is when people ask you, but how could racism turn into a health outcome, right? How could it turn into increased asthma prevalence in one community or the other, or increased obesity? So for that, to answer that question, as well as to answer how should we intervene, I find it useful to talk about racism on three levels: institutionalized, personally mediated, and internalized. So I'm going to very quickly define these. May I have a show of hands of everybody who knows the gardener's tale? Okay, now put your hands down. Anybody who didn't raise your hand, raise your hand. Okay, a few. So for those of you who know the gardener's tale, this is your opportunity to deeply own it so that you can tell it back. Okay? Because I was once advised by a very wise person, Francis Hubbard, I don't know if any of you know Francis, that I need to keep telling the gardener's tale until everybody can tell it back. So I'm going to very quickly define each of these levels of racism and then illustrate them with my gardener's tale allegory. Institutionalized racism is that system. It's, you know, the structures, policies, practices, norms, and values that result in differential access to the goods, services, and opportunities of society by race. This is the kind of racism that does not require an identifiable perpetrator. This is the kind of racism that often shows up as inherited disadvantage or its reciprocal inherited advantage. This is the kind of racism that has been institutionalized in our laws, in our norms, in our customs, in our policies and practices. And we see it in terms of material conditions as well as in terms of access to power. Differential access to quality housing or excellent educational opportunities or equal employment opportunities or even the same level of income at the same level of employment. Differential access to medical facilities, including linguistic access. Differential access to a clean environment. And that's about the whole well-documented disproportionate placement of toxic dump sites or bus transfer stations in communities of color. In terms of power, differential access to information could be health information or information about our own histories. Differential access to resources, capital resources, social networking resources. Differential access to voice and media and government and the like. And I need to quickly highlight that sometimes I've been challenged by having housing, education, employment, and income on this slide, which has a label institutionalized racism, because people say to me, Dr. Jones, isn't that really what we mean when we say social class? Are you talking about racism or are you talking about social class? Right? That's an important question. Some of you in this room are really wanting to hear my answer to that. And so I'm going to start the answer with the observation that it doesn't just so happen that people of color in this country are overrepresented in poverty while white people in this country are overrepresented in wealth. That is not just a happenstance. And I could give you a litany of, for each marginalized, stigmatized, oppressed group, there has been some initial historical insult. For American Indians, it started with the taking of the land and the near genocide and the moving of the survivors to reserve lands, the reservations, and in many instances, something good was found under one reservation. Oops, got to move people somewhere else. You know, you have people who were Mexican in Mexico, and then that part where they were became New Mexico and lynched and the like, and still their ancestors are being harassed today on the street. For people of African ancestry, it started with the kidnapping of West African people and our importation across the Atlantic with tremendous loss of life in the Middle Passage. And then for the survivors and their progeny, what I describe as the coerced usury of our unpaid labor for centuries to build this country. But then people have stopped me there. And they said, Dr. Jones, here you go talking about slavery. We recognize, they say, that that was an unfortunate chapter in our nation's history, but Dr. Jones, the enslaved people were emancipated in 1865, and we are now in 2015, and that is clearly 150 years ago. So, Dr. Jones, All else being equal, don't you think the impacts of slavery would have washed out by now? But the key phrase there is all else being equal. And all else has not been equal since 1865, and all else still is not equal today. And for each of you, for each of these oppressed, marginalized, stigmatized groups, those initial historical injustices are being perpetuated by contemporary structural factors that are part of what I'm describing as institutionalized racism. So when people ask, are you talking about racism or are you really talking about social class, I say that institutionalized racism explains why we even see an association between social class and race in this country. This is a very important insight, because as we go out on this national campaign against racism, people are going to say, but all doesn't it all reduce to social class and poverty? It does not. If you gave me, it is so important for us to eliminate poverty. I would go further. I would eliminate the income inequality gap. I would flatten it. I would. If you gave me a magic wand, boom, 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 I would do it. But if I did that without understanding that there are background structures, policies, practices, norms, and values that were deliberately put in place to differentially shunt different populations to different opportunities, if I eliminated poverty today and equalized income today, but did not address those mechanisms of institutionalized racism, then in one generation, in 20 years, we would start to see a stratification by race again in terms of social class. Before I leave institutionalized racism, I also need to say that it can be through acts of doing, acts of commission, as well as acts of not doing, acts of omission, and very often institutionalized racism shows up as inaction in the face of need. The second level of racism, personally mediated racism, I define as differential assumptions about the abilities, motives, and intents of others by race, and then differential actions based on those assumptions. That's what most people think of when they hear the word racism. Somebody did something to somebody, right? It includes the different ideas of prejudice, the different actions, the discrimination. Examples, my, police brutality. All I need to do is give you a litany of names now. I can't even keep track. Now, you know, police people have been brutalizing people of color and poor white people for centuries. We are just knowing more and more about it because of cell phones, right, and cell phone cameras. But, you know, I used to talk about somebody being pulled over for driving while black or driving while Latino and interpreted as resisting arrest and being hit upside the head as a health outcome of police brutality. Now I can just talk about, you know, Freddie Gray, Eric Garner, Mike Brown. I can just on and on and on. Tamir Rice. Trayvon Martin wasn't even a police officer, a self-appointed neighborhood watchman who looked at that young boy coming from the store, going back to his father's house and said, this boy does not belong here. Physician disrespect, which can be as subtle as a physician not giving a patient the full range of treatment options because the physician feels like that patient wouldn't understand, couldn't afford, wouldn't comply, or whatever they assume, or could be quite blatant, like sterilization abuse, which has had many iterations in our nation's history. Shopkeeper vigilance being followed around the stores, waiter indifference, not getting quick, respectful treatment. And these are just two elements of what many people call everyday racism. These are the microaggressions, the subtle communication of disrespect that may be related to elevated blood pressures in communities of color, elevated blood pressures that don't even go down at night. Teacher devaluation. That's an important manifestation of personally mediated racism. When a teacher looks at a young child and thinks that child can't learn, right, and puts them off in the ADD track, that child will never even know their full potential, much less have the ability to, you know, to develop to their full potential. Personally mediated racism, like institutionalized, can be through acts of doing, acts of commission, as well as acts of not doing, acts of omission, but more important, it can be unintentional as well as intentional. You don't have to have done something, you don't have to have meant to do something racist to have had a racist impact. The third level of racism, internalized racism, I'm speaking right now in a narrow sense about internalized racism from the point of view of members of the stigmatized races. Here I define it as acceptance by members of the stigmatized races of negative messages about our own abilities and intrinsic worth. I do acknowledge that many white people in this country walk around with an internalized sense of entitlement. I'm not addressing that right now, okay? Some people have suggested maybe that even goes into the, you know, when you talk about racism as a psychiatric illness, maybe that's the link, right? But from a point of view of stigmatized races, how could this adversely impact your health? Self-devaluation, feeling maybe I'm really not as good as, maybe I shouldn't, you know, try to graduate from high school or apply to that college or apply for that job or try to live in that neighborhood. And that self-devaluation manifests in the public health way, even in terms of fratricide, black on black, or Latino on Latino crime, because if you don't value yourself, you won't value somebody who looks just like me, and you just as soon off them as not. The white man's ice is colder syndrome, that phraseology came from my parents' generation and what it meant then and what it means for many folks today. If you are a person of color and you need a lawyer, you might go look for a white lawyer over a black lawyer, for example. Or if you needed, you know, a doctor, you might go look for a white doctor. If your lemonade were warm, you might go way down the street to get the white man's ice over the black man's ice, deeply believing that the white man's ice is colder, deeply internalizing the myth of white superiority. Internalized racism shows up as resignation, helplessness, hopelessness, lots of self-destructive health behaviors, not registering to vote, not voting even if you are registered, and really is about members of the stigmatized races accepting the limitations to our own full humanity of the box into which we've been placed. So, the gardener's tale allegory was sparked by something I saw with my own real eyes. I'm going to just briefly tell you what that was, then tell the story about racism. And then quickly give you some more allegories and then open it up so that you can give me advice about this national campaign. But I want to say, the reason that I tell the gardener's tale again and again and again is because people find that using this four-page paper, saying to your worker, your co-workers, or your students, I heard this story today, will you read this? And then let's have a brown bag lunch about that, is a very good way to start conversations about racism. Now, what did I see with my own real eyes before we make this a story about racism? My husband and I were moving to Baltimore. I was going to finish my PhD at Hopkins, and we bought our first freestanding house, our first little, you know, thing with a beautiful house with a big wraparound porch on it with flower boxes on the porch. And when spring came and we wanted to plant, we ran out and looked at our flower boxes, and we saw that some of them had dirt in them and some of them were empty. So my husband dutifully goes down to the gardening store. He hauls big old bags of potting soil. We fill up the empty boxes. And then we plant equal numbers of our marigold seeds in each of those boxes. And we water the boxes. And by this time, I've exhausted my gardening, you know, acumen. So at this point, I sit back just to be delighted, right? But 3 weeks later, when I'm walking out of my front door onto my porch, I looked at those flower boxes and I literally stopped in my tracks, because what I saw made me think that we had planted completely different species in some boxes versus the others. Because some of the boxes were full of plants and they were tall, vigorous looking plants, and some of the boxes just had a few plants in them and they were scrawny, scraggly looking plants. And then I realized what had happened. That potting soil that my husband had brought was rich, fertile soil, so that every single seed planted in the potting soil had at least sprouted. And the strong seed had grown very tall and vigorous, but even the weak seed had made it halfway up. But that old soil that we had found in those boxes turned out to be poor, rocky soil, so that the weak seed planted in the poor, rocky soil had died, and even the strong seed had to struggle to make it to a middling height. And if you guys are gardeners in here, maybe you've composted half of your garden, many of you have seen this image with your own real eyes, and the image is about the importance of the soil, the importance of the environment. But now I'm going to make this a story about racism by introducing a gardener. So now we have a gardener who has two flower boxes, one which she knows to have rich, fertile soil, and one which she knows to have poor, rocky soil, and she has seed for the same kind of flowers, except some of the seed is going to produce pink blossoms, and some of the seed is going to produce red blossoms, and this gardener prefers red over pink. So what does she do? She puts the red seed in the rich, fertile soil, the pink seed in the poor, rocky soil, and 3 weeks later in her boxes, she sees what I saw in mine. In that rich, fertile soil, all of the red seed has sprouted. The strong red seed has grown very tall and vigorous. The weak red seed has made it at least halfway up. In that poor, rocky soil, the weak pink seed has died. And the strong pink seed has to struggle to make it to a middling height. And then in these two flower boxes, those seeds, those flowers, go to seed. And the next year, the same thing happens. And then those flowers go to seed. And the next year, and the next year, and the next year, same thing happens. And finally, 10 years later, the gardener's looking at her flower boxes, and she says, you know, I was right to prefer red over pink. So we interrupt the story there to say that this is the first part. This first part of the story is how institutionalized racism works. You have the initial historical insult of the separation of the seed into the two types of soil. then the contemporary structural flower, you know, factors of the flower boxes, keeping the soil separate, and then through inaction and faceless need, perpetuation of the inequity. But we'll pick the story back up and just say, where is personally mediated racism in the garden? Well, that's when the gardener's looking over at red, loving red, and she looks over at pink and says, oh, those pink flowers sure are scrawny and scraggly, so she plucks off the pink blossoms before they can even go to seed. Or maybe she's noticed that a pink seed has blown into the rich, fertile soil, so she plucks it out before it can establish itself, which is a lot of the anti-affirmative action stuff that goes on. And where would internalized racism be in the garden? Where the red flowers are just living their lives, loving being red, many of them not even understanding or acknowledging that they're benefiting from enriched soil. The pink flowers are looking over at red, thinking red is mighty fine and wishing that they too could be red. And here come the bees. The bees are just minding their own business, but they're collecting nectar and, of course, pollinating at the same time. So here comes a bee into one of the pink flowers, and then to another pink flower, and then to this other pink flower, and that flower's like, get away from me, bee. Do not bring me any of that pink pollen. I prefer the red, because the pink flower has internalized that red is better than pink. So now the question arises, what do we do to set things right in this garden? Well, we can start by addressing the internalized racism, so we can go over to the pink flowers, and we can say, pink is beautiful, power to the pink, and that's an important intervention. It is an important intervention. I'm not making light of it, but if that's all we do, it's not going to change the situation in which they find themselves. Or you might say, okay, well, let's address the personally mediated racism, so let's have a conversation with the gardener. Or better yet, let's have a workplace multicultural workshop for the gardener. It's all good. So we have our workshop, and in the workshop we say, dear gardener, would you please stop plucking those pink flowers? And maybe she will, and maybe she won't. But even if she does, it's not going to change the situation in which those pink flowers find themselves. I think that if we really want to set things right in the garden, we need to address the institutionalized racism. It means we have to either break down the boxes and mix up the soil, or if we want to keep separate boxes, that's all right too, although in my mind it makes it easier for the gardener to continue segregating resources going forward. But if you keep separate boxes, it means you have to enrich that poor rocky soil until it's as rich as the rich, fertile soil, and when you do that, the pink flowers will flourish. They'll be looking beautiful, grand, and glorious, and in that intervention, they'll be looking at least as beautiful as the red. They've been selected, after all, for survival and strength. And when you have the pink and the red flowers looking equally beautiful, in that intervention on the institutionalized racism, you will have also addressed the internalized racism. And you may even address the personally mediated racism. Now, the original gardener may have to go to her grave preferring red over pink, but her children who grow up and see the flowers equally beautiful will be less likely to have that kind of attitude. So this story has been to illustrate these three levels of racism and to strongly suggest that if we want to set things right in the garden, we need to at least address the institutionalized racism. Good to address all the levels at the same time, but at least address the institutionalized racism. And when we do, the other levels may take care of themselves. Now, I haven't asked the question yet, a very important question, who is the gardener? Because after all, the gardener is the one that I gave the power to decide, the power to act, and control of resources, which in my mind are the elements of self-determination. And who is the gardener? Well, my slide used to say, who is the gardener of government? Power to decide, power to act, control of resources, until I went to CDC. So I amended my slide. But that doesn't make government any less part of the gardener. But government's not the only part of the gardener. Media, foundations, corporations, communities, to the extent that they have self-determination. But whoever the gardener is, it is dangerous when the gardener is allied with one group. I painted her red, that's why she prefers red over pink. And it's dangerous when she is not concerned with equity. When she can look at her flower boxes and think that her garden is beautiful, thank you, because she's not even counting the pink flowers as part of her garden. And so our challenge is what to do about the gardener. Do we make the gardener striped or polka dotted or fuchsia, you know, fuchsia? Do the pink flowers have to grow or recruit their own gardener? Lots of questions that can come out of this. I want to highlight, too, I was once asked, after I told this story, Dr. Jones, excuse me, why should the red flowers share their soil? Now, that's a very deep question, isn't it? First of all, it shows the power of this story for starting conversations about racism, which is why I continue to tell this story over and over, because if I were talking about racism between you and me, that question would never even come up. But my answer to that question, why should the red flowers share their soil, is that that soil does not belong to the red flowers. It belongs to the garden. Okay? But here's another question. What if that's not the original gardener? What if that's the gardener's great-great-great-great-grandchild? Here we are. What then? Because that great-great-great-great-grandchild has grown up seeing the flowers looking that way and may think that that is the natural state of affairs. So there are three lessons for us in that question. The first is that we have to make the differences in the height and vigor of the pink and red flowers a problem. We did that. Dr. Satcher and President Clinton did that in 1998 when they talked about, you know, eliminating racial ethnic health disparities. It used to be, you know, in the first healthy people and the second healthy people plan, 1990 and 2000, if you had black infant mortality here and white infant mortality here, the goal was to do this. Healthy people 2010, you know, we had to eliminate health disparities. So that's the first thing. So we're a little bit about that. But then how are we going to get that? How are we going to do it? We haven't been successful yet at eliminating health disparities, which points out that we have to make those flower boxes transparent. We need to be talking about the differences in the quality of the soil. And the third thing that is very important is we have to make it clear that the pink seed did not just jump over into that poor rocky soil, right? We need to talk about history, and we need to talk about the agency of the gardener in all of that. And in fact, my gardener's tale for many years was all about the differences in the quality of the soil. But I have come to understand that we also need to talk about the gardener's initial preference for red over pink. Many people would call, you know, that's a values statement, right? Many people would call that cultural racism or, you know, white supremacy ideology, but we need to address that because it was the gardener's initial preference for red over pink that set up the whole situation. And if we don't address that, and if we equalize the soil without addressing that, we will still have a problem going forward. Okay, so that's another part of our challenge. Institutionalized racism, I've just said, is the key. We need to look at opportunities as well as outcomes, but we need to understand that racism is not a cloud. It is not a miasma that we can't get a handle on. Racism is a system with identifiable and addressable mechanisms. So we have to be all about asking the question, how is racism operating here? Looking at structures, policies, practices, norms, and values, which are the mechanisms of decision-making. And all of these systems of structured inequity reside in decision-making. Structures, the who, what, when, and where of decision-making, who's at the table and who's not, what's on the agenda and what's not. Policies, the written how of decision-making. Practices and norms, the unwritten how of decision-making, and values, the why. And I just spoke to the importance of us including values in our realm of work. The definition that I gave us earlier about racism can actually be generalized to be a definition of any system of structured inequity. What is sexism? That's a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on gender that unfairly disadvantages, unfairly advantages, and saps the strength, right? We have to acknowledge that there are many axes of inequity going on in our society today, intersecting in communities and in individuals. They include race, gender, ethnicity, on and on and on, and all of these are operating at least as risk markers for how opportunity is structured and value is assigned, even as some are also risk factors in the progression to disease. So then you might ask me, and you might be asked as we go out on this national campaign against racism, why focus on race as the axis of inequity and racism as the system of inequity? And my answer to that is that racism is foundational in our nation's history. And yet many people today are in denial of its continued existence and profound impact on the health and well-being of our nation. So even as I recognize that all of this is going on, we must address racism. And what we learn, first of all, if we get that right, all these others will just fall in place. And what we learn from that will be beneficial to the others, but we must address racism. It's foundational in our nation's history. People are in denial of its continued existence, and it's having profound impacts on the whole society. I'm going to give you this definition of health equity because this is going to be part of the charge I'm going to give to all of the components of APHA. This is a three-part definition, and I'm going to want APHA to help operationalize this definition. The three parts are: what is health equity, how do we get there, and how is it related to health disparities? This is not the Healthy People 2020 definition. I contributed to the Healthy People 2020 definition. It's a great definition, but it differs from it in some subtle ways, and I'll tell you those as I present this. I define health equity as assurance of the conditions for optimal health for all people. Healthy People 2020 defines health equity as achievement of the highest level of health for all people. I agree that that is our goal, but what troubles me about that definition is, what if we hit that last Sunday? Are we done? I don't think that health equity is an outcome. I think of it as a process. Which process? As assurance, which is actually one of the three core functions of public health identified by the Institute of Medicine, along with assessment and policy development. Assurance of what? Of the conditions for optimal health, the social determinants of health, if you will. For whom? For all people. That makes it equity. Well, how do we get there? Achieving health equity requires valuing all individuals and populations equally, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, and providing resources according to need. And how is health equity so defined related to health disparities? Health disparities will be eliminated when health equity is achieved. Health disparities is about the differences in outcomes, the counting the numbers of different colored bodies at the bottom of the cliff, or counting the differences in the height and vigor of the pink and red flowers. Health equity is all about the distribution of resources and populations, the quality of the soil, and all of that. So I'm going to give you three more tools. Many of you will not be familiar with these allegories because I haven't published these yet. These are more tools for our armamentarium. They're going to help us address, well, but what is race biology? It's going to help us address that question. It's going to help us, but how do we talk about white privilege? And it's going to help us understand, what can I do to be actively anti-racist? This is too much for me, okay? So I'm going to give you these three stories, and then I'm going to start the brainstorming that I have about how APHA can incorporate these, and at this point, I definitely will need you to stand up and speak for us. The first of these three allegories was sparked by my experience when I was a medical student at Stanford, invited to a faculty member's garden party. And so, you know, the garden was festooned with Japanese lanterns and colored light bulbs, and it was wonderful. You know, I felt very grown up, actually, and here we are, you know, sitting and chatting and having hors d'oeuvres, and the music is flowing over us. And as night fell, I got a little bit weary, so I decided I was going to sit on the side of the garden and let the conversation and music just drift over me. And as I sat there, I became fascinated by a group of pink moths. And it was lovely. It was a zen experience. I was just, you know. And then my gaze shifted, and I saw, ooh, look at the green moths over there and the blue moths over there. And isn't it interesting how they're sorting according to their kind? Okay, for a minute. I really looked there, right? I mean, for a quick minute, I was like, But you realize, because you've seen moths under universal light, right, that I could have been in another part of the garden marveling at the yellow and the purple and the orange moths. And because you've seen moths under universal light, you recognize there's no such thing as pink or purple or blue or yellow or green or orange moths. Moths are different colors, yes, but they're different colors of tan and brown and speckled and splotched. I then had the realization that the colors that I thought I was seeing were due to the lights by which I was looking, and that the colored lights were distorting and masking our own true variability. And it started me thinking about this as a way to think about what is race and how do the racial categories that we construct distort our vision of who we are. And this was just a lovely little image about race as a social classification, not a biologic descriptor, as race as a social interpretation of how one looks in a race-conscious society. And if we're in a society that structures black, white, Hispanic, other lights, that's how we're going to see people. You go someplace else and you're going to have negro and, you know, pardo and all of that, that's what you're going to see. And only if we're going to look under a universal light, with a universal light, will we understand our own true variability and will we be able to access all that is all of us. A tiny little allegory on race as a social construct. The second image comes from my experience, again, when I was at Stanford as a medical student. I was studying late with some friends in the apartment, and we had no food. So we were hungry, and we decided we're going to go into town and try to find something to eat. We find a restaurant, we walk in, and we sit down. We order our food, food is served, and we are eating. No biggie, right? But as I'm sitting there eating, I looked up and I noticed a sign. And the sign said, open. And it hit me like a kick in the chest. It was a profound revelation to me about racism. And you're like, what, Kamara? What? What are you talking about? But here I was, sitting at the table of opportunity, eating, and I look up and I see a sign that says open. And if I had not known something about the two-sided nature of those signs, I would have thought that any other hungry person could have walked in, sat down, and eaten. But in fact, now, because of the time, the restaurant was closed, and hungry people just a few feet away from me, but on the other side of that sign, would not be able to come in, sit down, and eat. And all of a sudden, I understood that racism structures open-closed signs in our society, that racism structures a dual reality. And for those on the inside who are sitting at the table of opportunity and glance up and see a sign that says open, they do not even know that there's a two-sided sign going on, because it is difficult for any of us to recognize a system of inequity that privileges us. It is difficult for men to recognize male privilege and sexism. It is difficult for white people in this country to recognize white privilege and racism. It is difficult for all Americans to recognize our American privilege in the global context. Except we got a little touch of that, didn't we, with Ebola? Yet those on the outside are very well aware of the two-sided nature of the sign, because it proclaims close to them, but they can look through the window and see people inside eating. So for those who are inside the restaurant saying, is there really a two-sided sign? Does racism really exist? I say it's hard to know when you only see open. In fact, that's part of your privilege not to have to know. But once you do know, you can choose to act. It's empowering. It's not a scary thing. And if you care anything about those people on the other side of the sign, you're sitting in there, you're even closer to the people, you know, to the owner of the restaurant. You can say, open up the door. There are hungry people outside. Let them in. You'll make more money, and all the conversations we can have and the plans we can make. Or maybe you'll say, you know, you'll pass some food through the door or help tear down the sign or break through the glass. But whatever it is, you will not be sitting there thinking, why don't those people just come on in and sit down and eat? Because you'll understand something about the two-sided nature of the sign. The third allegory, and actually, I don't even know if I'll be able to do this. I'm going to have to do this. You're going to have to use your imagination, because I am tethered to this microphone, okay? But this allegory, life on a conveyor belt moving to action, is actually not by something I saw with my own real eyes, but by an image in the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, the former president of Spelman College. And in her book, she describes racism basically as a passive process. People not trying to be racist, but they're on this conveyor belt that's moving inexorably through racism and toward racism. They're just living their lives, right? I'm going to take that image, and I'm going to use that image to talk about how we can become actively anti-racist. So here we are on the conveyor belt, and we're just living our lives. You're going to have to imagine that we're on this conveyor belt. This is really bad. Let's see what I can do with this mic. No, not much. Okay. So here we are, we're on the conveyor belt, and we're just sending the kids to school, and we're going to work, and maybe we go to our club meetings or church or whatever it is. And we're not even looking up to see that there's racism all around us, or there's a big sign that says racism in front, if we looked up, because most people don't even look up, right? But some people might look up and they might see racism, then they close their eyes. They're still going to ride, but they close their eyes. They're in denial. Or maybe somebody looks up, they see racism, and they turn around, but they're still drifting, right? They're still on the conveyor belt, right? Maybe they're, you know, colorblind. Whatever. But what happens if we are on this conveyor belt and we get shocked into looking up and we see, oh my God, racism, we're surrounded by it and we're going toward it. What is our job? What do we do? And our job is, first of all, to turn around, but we can't just turn around because we'll just keep drifting toward racism. We have to turn around and we have to be active and we have to start walking backwards on this moving and crowded conveyor belt. And what happens when you start walking backward on a crowded conveyor belt? You're going to start bumping into people, right? And it's going to be uncomfortable for them and for you. And they're going to say, hey, buddy, watch out. Where are you going? And this is your opportunity to do the first of three stages of being actively anti-racist, which is to name racism. Say, do you see where we're going? Do you want to go there? Or will you turn around with me? Now, most people will say, just get out of my way, because they do not want to be disturbed out of their comfort. But maybe one or two will turn. So now you have one or two of you walking backwards on this crowded conveyor belt, and you keep bumping into people, and you keep naming racism, and you'll get more and more who will turn. I hope that we're going to get a lot of people to turn with us on this national campaign. Never 50%, not hoping for that. But we get more and more, so now we're able to develop some momentum, to pick up speed, right? So now we're not just staying in place walking backwards, but now we're actually getting closer and closer to the motor that is running this conveyor belt, right? So now, oh my God, there's the motor. This is our opportunity to do the second of three stages of being actively anti-racist, which is to ask, how is racism operating here? Looking at structures, policies, practices, norms, and values. And, oh my God, I think it's this lever. So I reach down and I pull up the lever, and, you know, it's the lever. The lever is part of it, and it starts shaking. But racism is a very smart system, and it reconfigures itself, and it keeps on moving, despite all of my lever pulling. Which points out the importance of the third stage of being actively anti-racist, which is to organize and strategize to act. So as I'm pulling on the lever, I need one of you there to push this button, and I need you to pull on the pulley, and I need you to spin that dial. And actually, I do believe that all of us working together can dismantle this system and put in its place a system in which all people can know and develop to our full potentials. So these three stories are also part of our armamentarium now, along with the cliff analogy about, you know, why we in health are going to talk about racism, along with the gardener's tale, how could racism impact health. Now we have Japanese lanterns about race as a social construct. We have dual reality about racism creating this two-sided sign, and this is how you can talk to people about white privilege. This is the tool for talking to people about white privilege. And then life on a conveyor belt, moving to action. This is about what we need to do, the three stages of being actively anti-racist. Name racism. Say the whole word. Say it all. Don't stop at race. You know, racism, you can get the ism out, right? You know, cultural competence, important. Discrimination, important. Implicit bias, important. But we need to name the system that makes race even have any relevance. Name racism. Ask, how is racism operating here? And organize and strategize to act. So what are our APHA tools to engage in this campaign on racism? Policies and advocacy and programs, you know, kind of the stuff that we do. Our components, the people that we have, and our partners, our bigger presence. So here are some of my ideas. First of all, I have to acknowledge that the APHA policy database had 31 hits when I put in racism. Okay? That's great. That's great. There were three policies that actually had racism in the title of them. 74, racism in the healthcare delivery system. 82, avoiding the public health consequences of anti-immigrant racism. And 2001, research and intervention on racism as a fundamental cause of ethnic disparities in health. But there are 28 others that also name racism in their thing. So we have a policy basis. We are not going to be dragging APHA in this. As you heard Dr. Wright talking about before, we're not dragging APHA, a long history of dealing here. We have, as Dr. Wright described before we started this session, the webinar series on racism and health. Can you imagine 10,000 people logged into one or more of these four sessions? Broke APHA's record by a long mile. And so I hope that you will let Dr. Wright have the input about what else we can be doing with that. We also have the APHA annual meeting as part of our program. I looked for racism, then we got 5 hits. Well, okay. So there are a lot of people talking about things that are racism. You don't have to say racism to be talking about racism, but I think it's better to say it because then we can all be clear what we're talking about. So I'm sure there's stuff on criminal justice and education and housing and all of that. I'm clear on that. But I actually think that we have to name racism if we're going to be motivating people. So here's one of my new ideas. What if we established a racism and health collaborative that any individual members and organizational members wanted to join and had 7 aspects? I'm patterning these over the 7 standing committees that we had in the CDC's racism and health work group. Those were communication and dissemination, education and development, global matters, liaison and partnership, organizational excellence, policy and legislation, and science and publications. What if we did that? What if we had an open line with the president once a month? So I don't know when the collaborative is going to meet. Maybe it'll be in conjunction with that. But that anybody in the association, anybody out there in the public space, could call in same time, you know, fourth Friday from 12 to 1, and I would be on the phone. It would be a web space or a phone space. I don't know how we would structure it to talk about what are we doing, what are we seeing in our communities, where are we going to go from here? Not just with me. I would be, you know, like the host, right? But we would be talking to one another. In our components, I'm going to ask people to help operationalize health equity. What does it mean to value all individuals and populations equally from the HIV/AIDS section or from the medical care section or public health nursing or from the affiliates, from the Massachusetts affiliate, the Hawaii affiliate, or from the caucuses? What does it mean from our forms and spigs? Does it mean that we have to ask who's at the table and who's not? What's on the agenda, what's not? Does it mean that we need to confront inaction in the face of need? I want people to operationalize that. What does it mean to recognize and rectify historical injustices? It starts with asking, how did this problem that we're trying to solve come to be this way? What needs to be done to create an even playing field? It includes teaching and being accountable for all of our full histories. What does it mean to provide resources according to need? First of all, we have to agree on a metric of need. That might be the hardest part. But then we have to become comfortable with providing to the neediest while the others wait. Did you hear me? We have to become comfortable with providing to the neediest while the others wait. We have to acknowledge that there are current differences in power and resources. And as much as advantaged people don't want to understand or acknowledge that they're advantaged, there are real differences. And if one state gets $1 million for its five county, it has five counties, each county doesn't necessarily have to get $200,000, right? So, but I want to challenge each of our components to operationalize these things and at the end of the year, compile these things, and we'll have a compendium, an APHA compendium on operationalizing health equity that could help the field. I also want each of our components, our sections, SPIGs, forums, caucuses, affiliates, to enlist a representative, maybe a section counselor or the like, as a member of this Racism and Health Collaborative. I want all of them to in some way ask the question, how is racism operating here? Looking at structures, policies, practices, norms, and values. I would like all of our components to identify and catalog anti-racism efforts that they come across, or to look for them. And I would certainly want all of our components to study the 9-page International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and to study the 14-page concluding observations, and maybe even identify one or more paragraphs as a basis for action. In terms of partnerships, I have lots of people who said, we want to partner, but now I am going to be quiet, and I want to invite, I know that there's some people in this audience who already are sort of ready to say publicly that they want to join APHA, but I want to invite anybody at this point to actually come up, make a line behind me, because there's only one mic, and I want us to start talking now. This is our time. Thank you.
First of all, I want to recognize our great and illustrious incoming president and want to say that we are so excited as members of APHA from across the world to actually join you in this initiative. And my name is Al Richmond. I'm Executive Director of Community Campus Partnerships for Health. And I want to today to declare that our organization is one of the founding organizations of this effort, and that our focus will really be focused on how community campus partnerships can work together to address these issues around racism. Again, I applaud her for her effort, her for her leadership, and I certainly encourage and challenge other executive leadership members to step forward to join us in this effort today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I employed Dr. Jones as well, and it's about time we have a national movement like this. All right. So as the president of the Public Health Association of New York City, FANIC, we are going to join in this effort as part of my mandate under my leadership. And we're going to work with organizations in New York City, including the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, to advocate for policies that are going to decrease structural racism.
Thank you.
Thank you.
to applaud this leadership because this is what we need. We each have been doing something, but it's a leader that brings us together and empowers us. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Vicki Mays, and I'm going to represent the American Psychological Association, APA, which is huge. It's going to be conducting a national survey of the relationship between racism and stress. And it will have a national dialogue about how stress is related to racism. So we're very happy to join you, Kamar.
Thank you, Vicki.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Bird, and in 2001, I was the first and unfortunately the only to date American Indian to serve as president of the American Public Health Association. So John Wayne, you weren't successful. I also want to say that I consider myself, and it's on my badge actually, I consider myself, I'll read it to you, Indigenous Immigration Expert. Because who else has been dealing with immigrants longer than Indians? So trump that.
Good afternoon. Hello, how are y'all doing? So my name is Dr. Luella Tony Lewis. I am a family doc and geriatrician, and proud to wake up every day as chair of healthcare for the Service Employees International Union, which represents 2 million service workers across the country in Canada and in Puerto Rico, and 1 million healthcare workers. And we are committed deep in our souls. Let me tell you, if I wasn't trying to be committed, our members would raise it. Those in the history of A. Philip Randolph Institute, and I am a man, look, black labor, brown labor, immigrant labor, working folks fighting for dignity, justice, and respect are on board. And we look forward to partnering across the world on this to make sure that we raise the issue and that we end these structures that have kept us down. I love that one of my brothers in Mississippi said, you know, organized labor, especially organized labor for black and brown and those that have been disenfranchised, was put in place to help to decrease, to end the exploitation of workers for cheap labor. So I'm proud to serve in that capacity. Additionally, I work with our global affiliate, the Public Services International Union, which represents public workers, 20 million across the globe. I just recently got back from Botswana, where I met with workers from across Africa, and I will engage the global union in our campaign to make sure we work on the treaty, to make sure we invest in public health infrastructure, and that we bring the full force of frontline workers, hearts, minds, and souls to this fight.
Thank you.
I'm Shoma Stout. I'm from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and I have the privilege of leading something called 100 Million Healthcare Lives, which brings together about 650 partners that reach over 100 million people in this country. And we're not only honored to be partners with APHA in creating the healthiest nation, we're explicitly named equity as the price of admission in 100 million, with a special focus on racism called out as something that we need to work on. So we're proud to be part of this partnership with you.
Hi, I'm Tony Sloth. I'm up here as the chair of the policy committee for APTR, also former president of that organization. That's the Association for Prevention, Teaching, and Research. And this is a little bit premature because this has gone through the committee and the board, but not the membership. So I might be bumping some members on the conveyor belt, having turned around quicker than they have. So my apologies to them, but I'm dragging you with me. So where we are, APTR has really established a new policy process, and we have our articulating not as a policy, but as the policy that will concern us for the next however long it takes, the dismantling of structural racism, particularly in the place where we're at, which is academic institutions where health professionals are taught. You know, in many ways, the danger for academics is that we are almost by definition sort of useless and immaterial, but if you think about it, universities are a place where the myth of meritocracy is maintained and where, in fact, the structures of inequity are maintained and go forward. So I think that we are actually in a very special place to make sure that all health professionals and really everyone who comes to a university needs to be taught all of what you spoke today, and not only be taught it, but to have the conversations and own it. So we'd like to see all universities take this on, and we'll do our part.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm glad you mentioned universities. I'm Michelle Kelly, and I work at the University of Illinois Chicago. We're fraught with structural racism, and I think that if you look at who's leading in the faculty positions, largely white, we're totally unprepared to talk about this subject except in a very surface level. And our students love the gardener's tale. And that just gets people kind of in the door to talk about it, though. There's so much more that we need to be doing. The Association for Schools of Public Health, great institution, great people, largely led by all white leadership. And the conversation doesn't change that much. I've been listening. If you look at the competencies for the Master's in Public Health program, so superficial the way we talk about community, so superficial the way we talk about race, and for the undergraduates as well. So we need, the practicums don't speak to this either. We need to do something serious. Okay? And can I say, sociologist Pierre Bordeaux says, a university is a structuring structure, socializing. So, thank you.
Call out to all of you who are APHA members, because if we're going to have this conversation, we have to start at home. And we have to ask ourselves, what the hell are we doing? How do we set up a policy process so we can no longer even discuss hard topics in our governing council? That's why you only found, however, few on racism. Not a scientific concept, but not measures, not true. But we can't discuss the Palestinian issues. Talk about. Now I'm going to tell you something. I know something about racism, and that sure looks like it to me. But we can't even argue about it. You don't have to agree. No. Who are we training, and what are we training them in? Where are reports that we used to have on how the association is doing, what the composition of the components are? We have to start at home before we think that we can give leadership across the board. What the hell is the culture of health? Does that help or hinder the fight against racism? We have to be willing to have these kind of hard conversations amongst the family. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to have these hard conversations in the broader nation and world.
Greetings, Claude Jacob. I serve as the health officer in Cambridge, the city of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Also a member of the health administration section. I just want to commend you for your wonderful presentation. I remember the first time I had heard the story, I believe it was about 20 years ago, as one of the presentations sponsored by the Black Caucus of Health Workers. I'm a member of the Black Caucus of Health Workers. And so I just want to say, representing the community of local health officials, we are 2,800 strong. The National Association of County and City Health Officials. I'm a board member. It's pronounced Nacho, not Nacho. So So just want to say that we're proud of your accomplishments. We appreciate the tools that you've shared with us. We're looking for the ongoing frameworks that support our mission around health, security, and equity. And so we just want to say thank you for your energy, thank you for your guidance, and we're looking forward to being a part of the community that helps to support and address these issues in our community. So thank you again.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dr. Lisa Maybank, and I am Associate Commissioner, New York City Department of Health, and Founding Director of the Center for Health Equity. I'm also Vice Chair and sit on the committee with Claude at NACHO to help support city and county officials across the country. But first, I want to definitely say congratulations and thank you for the leadership. As many of you know, Commissioner Bassett, Mary Bassett, is our health commissioner, and I have a tremendous opportunity and have recognized the power and the importance of leadership to be able to open those doors and see those open door signs, and how when you have that opportunity, we have to capitalize on that moment. So we're at a great opportunity for synergy across many places in the country, and so we at the New York City Department of Health are definitely going to be with you in support, you know, and thinking about the challenges. The other challenge that I put to everybody is also there's a broader movement that clearly is happening in this country right now, and hashtag Black Lives Matter, and how are we going to be connecting to that movement? What are those opportunities? Because as many of us know, movements are really generated and sustained right now by young people, and so we have to think about how are we going to create those plans and those connections for APAJ with hashtag Black Lives Matter.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Diane Waugh, and I am an occupational physician in the Washington, D.C. area. And I work for a large government agency, which will remain unnamed, as I cannot speak for them. But I'm a delegate to the House of Delegates for the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, representing the D.C. chapter. And in addition, I'm a member of the society, the section on underserved occupational populations for ACOM. And I'm just so excited by what Kamara has expressed today, what she lives for in a large sense, and her work. And what I want to do is to work with the section on underserved occupational populations to bring a resolution to the House of Delegates in support of this, and to see just how we can actually address this racism, the issue, and to name it, as Kamara said, to actually name it in something that we speak. When we're dealing with occupational medicine and occupational populations, there's so much that's unsaid in terms of what the jobs that people have and why they have them, and their ability to move from job to job. It's unstated, and we want to bring it out.
My name is Dr. Peter Orris. I'm Chief of Occupational Environmental Medicine at in the clinical service here at the University of Illinois. Truth be told, I saw everybody getting a hug who came up here. I wanted to remember this day very clearly after I heard this stirring and very important lecture, and brilliantly placed as a tool for us to move ahead. And more importantly, I guess, I work with a group called Healthcare Without Harm. This is a group that is dedicated toward redesigning healthcare so that its environmental footprint is far less invasive and oppressive. And we are now all over the world, and we cope every day with the questions of how the environment is filtered through racial discrimination and racism in country after country, so that, as you all know, not only is racism a social concept, but the questions of the effects of climate change mediated through racism is what makes it is most scary, and what is the most problematical aspect of climate change. And the globe itself has the capability, and the people have a capability of coping with climate change and mitigating climate change, but are prevented from doing so by the divisions primarily of questions of racism on a global scale. And we, coping with that daily, are not well put yet on how one identifies it, calls it, and figures out practical ways to craft the message so it is clear and involving people. And these tools that you've talked about will be very interesting for us. So all I can offer is opening the dialogue. I've got no thousands with me, but we can see where we go from there. Thank you.
Congratulations, Kamara. You're off to a great start, and I guess you haven't even started yet. I think some of you know that Kamara spent over a year with us at the Satya Health Leadership Institute. She was on detail from the CDC, so she's had a long time to work on me. So she's not just starting, but I was just thinking, you know, we define public health as the collective efforts of a society to create the conditions in which people can be healthy. And let me tell you, the condition of racism is not a condition in which people can be healthy. I often divide sort of my life experiences into at least three stages. A child in Anniston, Alabama, I almost died of whooping cough and pneumonia, but I couldn't be admitted to the hospital. Neither could Dr. Jackson admit to the hospital. So I sort of saw myself as first a victim. Then I got to college at Morehouse, and for the first time really felt that I had an opportunity with other students to confront racism. So I went to jail, even went to prison once, in this effort to confront racism. And we made some progress in terms of changing laws and policies in terms of where you could eat or sleep and things like that. And then the phase that I struggle with is the third phase, in which I see my responsibility in terms of leadership in dealing with racism. The thing I like about the way Kamara conceptualizes the issue is that it's not pointing the fingers at anybody except ourselves and realizing that we're all victims. And if we're ever going to solve the problem, we have to decide together that we've been victims too long. And we're going to work together to overcome it. We did it with smallpox. We eradicated smallpox in the world. We've eliminated polio in most places in the world. And I was quite involved with the India effort a few years ago. I remember 1 week in 1995, we immunized 100 million children in India in 1 week. And so right now we see polio is eliminated in India. There are only about three countries left, and most of those still have polio because of political issues. I'm only saying that to say, if we really put our minds to it and work together, we can eliminate racism. And then, of course, we can start thinking about eradicating it all over the world. So congratulations. I'm encouraged. I look forward to working with you.
Dr. Jones, I want to thank you very much for this work that you've been doing for a long time without acknowledgement. My name is Dr. Chandra Ford, and I want to offer partnerships in three ways. First, I'm speaking just as one person who's committing publicly to do this work and to continue to do this work around racism and health. Secondly, as a member of the Minority Affairs Committee of the American College of Epidemiology, the college is already committed to that type of work, and in particular the Minority Affairs Committee. And then finally, as I'm speaking on behalf of Colin Zariabua and myself, and saying that the work that we're doing around public health critical race praxis to try to draw on the critical race theory movement within law and other fields. Oops.
We will really work to make this, to support the efforts of APHA in order to make this more of a mass movement and organized movement. So thank you.
Thank you.